I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The largest beef recall in Canadian history took place in recent weeks. It's made a lot of people think about what they consume, how they get it, and whether they should look at alternatives. My guest now has a timely new book out, High Stakes, Why and How to Eat Less Meat. She looks at the meat we North Americans consume, how and where it's raised, how it's slaughtered, and what we ought to consider when we're ingesting the 200 pounds of animal protein that North Americans on average consume per year. I'll get Eleanor Boyle, who joins me now, to tell us about what she's found out in the course of writing this book, the timing of the book's release, to what's going on in Canada and what we can do, what we can all do to in the course of our eating. Eleanor Boyle is a former journalist who is a noted writer and instructor in food policy here in Vancouver at the Center for Sustainability at the University of British Columbia. She holds a PhD in neuroscience, a BA in behavioral science, and a Master of Science in Food Policy. Her website is at eleanorboyle.com. This book is published by New Society Publishers. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Eleanor Boyle. Dr. Boyle, good morning.
Hello, Joseph. Nice to be with you here. Please call me Eleanor.
Thanks for joining us. It is a tad silly, isn't it, that we have to preface the interview by saying that you're not some vegan or vegetarian on a crusade to try to get us to not eat meat, right?
I'm definitely not suggesting that people need to become vegetarian.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If anybody wants to make that decision, fine. But what I'm saying the scientific research shows is that to tackle this global problem, these serious global problems of the environmental and health downsides of livestock and meat, what large numbers of people need to do is become more discerning in their meat intake. But Joseph, let me address the vegan-vegetarian issue. I am an open book. I say right in the introduction that I do not eat meat myself. That is a choice that I've made. Works for me. But if anyone would suggest that, you know, I'm not objective, I would say, first of all, I'm not recommending it for anybody else. It's a personal choice.
Yeah.
I'm saying what the science says large numbers of people need to do. And I also say that, you know, we all have points of view, meat eaters as well, and I'm trying to move beyond labels,
yeah,
not worry about who eats meat and who doesn't, but say that if you do, let's do it more discerningly.
And does it frustrate you that when you try to engage in a conversation like this, it's a necessary conversation to have because of, well, food supply, food security, and the sort, that these labels do come up?
They sure do. They absolutely do. Since I began getting involved in food issues over the last number of years, as you know, as many of your listeners and your readers will have as well, I found that the meat issue doesn't tend to get discussed as fully and as openly as they should, because there tends to be a divide between vegetarians and meat eaters. And I've heard meat eaters make derogatory comments about vegetarians, and I've heard the opposite.
Yeah.
And I really feel like, hey, let's all get together, not worry about labels, and realize that we really all do have the same objectives for safety and for health. And I think we can move beyond that divide.
Now, I mentioned off the top the food, the beef recall.
Yeah.
It's the largest in Canadian history.
Yeah.
It was caused by, E. coli, right?
E. coli is the problem. It's the pathogen.
Yeah.
It's the thing that causes the disease. I hesitate to say yes to your sentence because you said E. coli caused it. What I'm encouraging people to do is stand back and say, these kinds of food contamination events don't have a single cause, so that food inspectors are in there trying to figure out with their magnifying glasses exactly what the problem was, what the procedural difficulties were, what production lines seem to have been the source. But what I'm saying is we can all stand back and go, hey, this really is a much bigger issue than that, and there is no single cause. All of us, given our expectations that we should have meat at virtually every meal and that it should be inexpensive, we're contributing to these problems, because really the only way to make that amount of meat at those low prices is to crank it through in these highly intensive systems that make it very difficult to avoid food contamination. So I'm going, hey, we can all help in the future, help our society, help our companies develop better food systems that are more likely to avoid contamination, and we can do that by eating less meat and be willing to pay more for what we do make, produced in sustainable operations.
Now, we first heard about E. coli, say, about 20 years ago. I guess it was Jack in the Box when their hamburgers had it. Now, for people listening to us that probably haven't picked up the book and probably don't understand what E. coli is, beef does not have it, per se, right? I mean, if you get a piece of red meat, that doesn't mean that it has E. coli. It's something that happens as it's being processed, right? Something that affects the meat, I guess?
Okay, good questions. E. coli, as a bacterium, is actually a natural component of the guts, of the intestines, mm-hmm. of many animals, particularly cattle. We have lots of bacteria in our bodies, and so do livestock, and to a degree, it is natural. It's a question. That's why manure and waste has to be handled carefully at all times. Once you get intensive systems that are cranking a lot of animals through, it's very difficult to be as sanitary and as careful as one wants to be. But E. coli is, to some degree, in many cattle, natural components of the gut.
And then so when we get, say, recalls on spinach or lettuce because of E. coli, it has to do with, say, manure that a farm, where farms use, it gets into the system, right?
Yeah, Joseph, I mean, you raised a really good point, and this is one that I really want people to think about, because I've heard the criticism, E. coli doesn't necessarily just come from meat, because we hear spinach and cantaloupe and so forth. And I say, in many of those cases, probably the vast majority of spinach contaminations, other veg contaminations, it came from excessive livestock manure. And so we don't want to eat less spinach. What we want to do is eat less meat, because it comes back to the number of livestock on the planet right now, including in Canada, the United States, in our regions, is so large, especially when they're produced in these so-called factory farms intensively. Yeah. There's so much manure that it's far more than just can be used as just the right amount of fertilizer on nearby lands. There ends up being so much of it that it ends up being dumped in excess on agricultural lands. That is one of the major causes of a lot of these food contaminations.
What about the argument that reducing our meat consumption will affect industry, not just, say, the farming and food processing industry, but, say, restaurants and service-based industries as well?
I have empathy for everybody in this story. Making changes in our food systems is never easy, and there may be people who will have to make adjustments and who will be disadvantaged, at least in the short term, as, society is trying to make these changes. I have total empathy for this. But I have to say, people want to eat out. People like to eat out. If restaurants were to substitute some percentage of their meat meals with veg meals, customers would come in and buy it. It would be what's on the menu, and if it were produced, cooked well, people would love it. There doesn't have to be a lot of disadvantage. One person accused me of trying to put livestock producers out of business, and I feel actually pained by the idea that anybody would be disadvantaged, but social change is, when there is social change to try to correct problems, people are sometimes disadvantaged, and we just have to figure out, as compassionate members of society, how to help, say, farmers transition to more sustainable ways of doing things. This is happening in crop production as well, the whole sustainable food movement, trying to help farmers use less pesticides, use less fertilizers. This is all part of a larger movement. And I guess I would just have to say that most people in this sustainable food field would say that ultimately, when we start producing our food in ways that are more consistent with ecology, there's actually going to be more jobs, not fewer. Because right now, say we're spraying a lot of chemicals, that replaces a lot of labor. It doesn't ultimately cost us any less because the chemicals are so expensive. Mm-hmm. It's been shown that when fewer chemicals are used, you may need more people to weed the crops, but ultimately you don't lose any money. Ultimately, in fact, more people get jobs and you produce food more in a more healthy way.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this is a conversation that few are willing to have. And do you think that governments have a role in this? I mean, in this country, at least, they do support, they encourage, and they in some jurisdictions, subsidize food production, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And our governments tend to be, I don't want to say biased, our governments tend to lean toward, shall we say, the mass production, export-oriented companies. And this is something that a lot of people are saying now really needs to be rethought. And governments would do well for health and the environment to more support the more sustainable producers, which often are smaller. It doesn't mean they're tiny. There are medium and large sized companies that are sustainable. But yeah, governments definitely have a role.
Yeah. And just to back up for just a sec here, this idea of food security, I used the term earlier and I just realized that perhaps people listening might not know what that is.
Yeah.
Does that mean making sure that we have food down the line? Or does it mean making sure that our food that we have now is safe to consume and the sort?
That's a really good point. I mean, there's a whole movement now that a lot of people call the food security movement. There's also other terms that people may have heard. Food sovereignty is a term being used a lot. Food democracy, food sustainability. They're all nuances on the same idea, which is, first of all, that we as compassionate human beings who want a good world, first of all, have to feed people. And one of the shocking things, despite the fact that there's actually enough food in the world, is that there's close to 1 billion people still who are chronically hungry. We've got to address that. And I would argue that moderating our meat consumption would actually help that. Secondly, we have to provide people with food that's safe and that did not massively harm the environment in its production. So all of those are part of food security. Food security is the idea that we should feed people, that we should feed them healthfully and in ways that don't harm the planet.
Now, can livestock and cattle, can they be raised in a way that's sustainable, that it doesn't degrade the land? I mean, that's something that you show us in the book, right?
Absolutely. It's really important to realize that there are lots of sustainable livestock ranchers right now, ranchers and farmers in British Columbia, elsewhere in Canada, the United States, all over the world. There are people raising livestock in ways that are good for the environment, not bad. I mean, for example, across the southern prairies, there are grasslands that there's nothing better you could do with them than to graze ruminants, which is cattle, goats, and sheep. Nothing better you could do for it. It's a very symbiotic relationship, very advantageous both to the animals and to the land. And there are also very sustainable ways of raising chickens and pigs. And a lot of meat can actually be produced this way, as sustainable producers are showing. It doesn't have to be, you know, three cows. It really can be done in a way that produces a lot of meat. There's a whole industry, and if you're people listening who are interested in this, you know, look up people like Joel Salatin, like Michael Pollan, like read my book for some of the sustainable livestock producers. It absolutely can be done.
You talked to a farmer in North Carolina, Don Webb.
Yeah.
He's a pig farmer?
He was a pig farmer until he realized that his pig farm was ruining the lives of the people who lived right around him, and he felt so terrible that he sold his pigs and became an advocate of smaller scale production, became an advocate against these intensive operations.
Yeah, and I mean, he had a good point about... It's almost humorous where he says that, he still likes pork.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He enjoys his pork, absolutely. But I'm sure he doesn't eat it at every meal, and probably not every day.
Yeah.
Because he's really come to see that, hey, we need to, we can still enjoy meat, but we need to be a little more discerning.
Yeah, and it's just the effects of the environment. We learned that in this book. The biggest challenge, I guess, is change, and changing even on a small scale.
Yeah.
Thinking about what one eats at a meal,
mm-hmm.
Reducing meat essentially.
Yeah.
I guess cost. I think that that's the biggest impediment, right?
Well, I really think that habit is the biggest impediment, but we can all change our habits. Any one of us can look back at something that we used to do that we've stopped doing because we realized it wasn't good for us. We can all change habits, although I agree it's not that easy. I give people a couple of tips. You can continue to eat almost precisely the way that you do now, but make meat a side dish, not the main large dish in the center of the plate. It doesn't need to be. Move it to the side, make less, and increase the number of the fruit of the veggies and the potatoes and whatever else you eat. And that is the simplest thing to do. Secondly, you can substitute into your favorite meals, whether it be pizzas or stews or soups or whatever you really like to eat. Substitute at least part of the meat ingredients for some lentils and some root vegetables, and then experiment a bit, particularly with cuisines from parts of the world that have traditionally minimized the meat. Chinese cuisine, Mexican, Indian. These are all fabulous sources for figuring out nice ways to minimize the meat that aren't that different from how we eat today.
Now, you mentioned earlier that, you talked about your own habits and sort of that you don't eat meat yourself,
yeah.
And that you have in the book a number of recipes on how we can add, say, vegetables to our meal. Did that take time for you, or is that just because it's part of your work that you found it easy to do?
You know, changing your food habits, for most people, is a process that takes a long time. I mean, when I was in my teens, way back when, I heard something about the way the animals were treated, and I became vegetarian for like a year. And I didn't really have a solid knowledge foundation to base it on, so I went back to eating meat. And then many years later, someone gave me a book, and I read more, and I learned more, and then I decided, yeah, I would cut out meat. Since then, I've modified my habits to and fro. I think people should relax about it, realize that, you know, shifting food habits is a process. It can take time. Don't worry about whether you're going to eat meat or not. Just relax and try to be more discerning, and that will take time. It will take learning some new ways of doing things. Yeah, it's all a process.
Now, looking down the line, looking towards the future, will meat prices, will they remain cheap, or do you think that they'll go up because of say, people changing their habits?
Well, there's a number of reasons that meat prices probably will rise, at least in the short term, and I think they already are. Of course, the drought in the United States is such that a lot of feed that livestock animals have been used to fatten livestock are simply not available at the low prices that they had been previously. If we look more deeply, we also see that this very drought is almost certainly climate change related, and when we moderate our meat intake, we help slow global warming. We help slow greenhouse gas production. So becoming more discerning about our meat intake is just good for everything, even good for avoiding droughts in the future or minimizing droughts in the future. It all ties in. Meat prices have been rising, but the big picture of that is that they're heavily resource intensive. To make a pound of steak or chicken or pork takes a lot more than a pound of plant material, a lot more. Animals eat a lot to produce a pound of meat, and they also use a lot of fresh water. So, yeah, as our resources get stressed, prices of meat are going to go up. If we as a society figure out ways to start winding down some of these factory farms and supporting more sustainable livestock producers, our meat prices are going to go up too. But we've got to stop focusing always on price. One of the arguments that people in sustainable food makers, they say, hey, North Americans are accustomed to spending only 10% of their disposable income on food, which is a lot less than the rest of the world. And meanwhile, we've got iPods and iPads and everything else and three pairs of running shoes. And, you know, if we shifted our priorities a little, we'd probably be able to pay a little more for food that was healthier.
Say, doesn't E. coli breakout like we've had in recent weeks, does that affect consumption in the long term? And just say, is it a good thing for people like you in wanting to reduce meat consumption?
I feel terrible about the E. coli outbreak, and I feel really terrible for everybody, not only who got sick, and I thank goodness that it hasn't been fatal in any cases, but I feel terrible for everybody who's afraid of their food supply. So it's not good in any way, but does it change attitudes? I think there have been enough food contaminations, and as you pointed out earlier, there have been enough, that slowly it has been eroding the purely positive views that people had about meat. And there is statistical evidence in the States and in Europe that a lot of people are beginning to eat less meat.
Yeah. And in the course of promoting this book, because the book came out around the time that this all broke, have you found that people are receptive to the idea of eating less meat?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been on a number of radio programs across the country, including phone-ins, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Alberta, fascinating. In Alberta, I expected a lot of opposition. No, people were phoning and saying, this is such a good idea, and we really care about the reputation of our meat industry. That's one of the reasons that myself and my family are actually cutting back. We're having a couple of meatless dinners each week. So I'm getting a lot of support. I had one phone-in in Saskatchewan saying, eating less meat would be like cutting off my right arm.
Yeah.
And one phone in Victoria saying, this eat less meat thing, I certainly hope it's not going to be mandatory. And I said, no, don't worry, it's not going to be mandatory. So, but I'm open and empathetic to any point of view. I just think we all need to talk.
Yeah. And that's what we've done today, and that's what one does when they read this book. I suggest that people do pick it up. It's fascinating stuff. Thanks for this, Eleanor.
Thank you, Joseph.
And continued good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph, and to all of your listeners.
You're very welcome. The book is called High Stakes, Why and How to Eat Less Meat. It's from New Society Publishers. Its author, Eleanor Boyle, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.